I used to be very goal driven. So, you know, I said how I wanted to be a physio from age 12.
Yeah.
That's a good example. I always had a goal. You know, I wanted to be a physio. I wanted to go to the Olympics. And I was always so intent on the next goal that I don't think I was enjoying the now enough.
Yeah.
Because I always wanted to get to the next point. And then I'd achieve that. And then I was like, right, what next? Whereas I've had so much reflection now to be like, well, actually, what's the point in always aiming for that next goal? Let's really try and enjoy the process.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Our guest this week is Emma Levy. Emma hosts a podcast called When Life Gives You Lemons, which is about mindset and resilience, where she interviews high-performing individuals that have been through adversity but came back even stronger. With decades of experience as a top physiotherapist who has helped elite athletes on their way to Olympic success, Emma was thrown a curveball in 2020 when she was diagnosed with breast cancer. Emma talks about how gratitude and planning for the future saved her life, as well as her love for sports. Emma, thank you so much for coming to This Is Powerful.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to be here.
I'd love to know where you're from and how was your upbringing?
So I have a fairly boring story, I think, in that I'm from London, grew up in North London in a Jewish family. I have two brothers, and it was a fairly pleasant upbringing. I had most material things I wanted. I had a lot of love. Grew up as the middle girl between my two brothers. Always was quite into school. Was more into the sports side, but I liked school. Loved hanging out with friends, was a very sociable person. From, you know, secondary school, probably I was a bit shy in primary school.
Sound very boring.
Well, you know, there was nothing that interesting. It was all really nice.
Yeah. I think that means a healthy, nice, normal upbringing.
Yes, it was.
So you mentioned sports. So was you just naturally attracted to sports, and what sports did you do?
I was probably naturally attracted to sports in that my mum was always quite sporty. My dad, not so much. But they, you know, they encouraged exercise as a family. So we'd go for cycle rides and things like that. And I was very good at tennis. I don't know how that really came about, but I remember going to group lessons and being very little, and then the teacher saying, oh, you know, saying to my mum, she's really good. Can I give her private lessons and see like what we can do? So I ended up being quite a high level tennis player. Uh-huh. When I say high level, I got to county level. I never got national level, but you know, county level was pretty good.
Yeah.
But I actually hated the competitive side.
Really?
I was awful. I would just fall apart under the pressure. And I remember going to play these matches, and also it's very lonely as a tennis player. And I didn't like that. I much preferred the team sport at school. You know, I much preferred playing netball, being part of a team. Because on a tennis court, you are fully by yourself. And I'd go to these matches and I'd be against these other girls and the parents as well of these other girls. You know, the pressure. They would shout at them. And my parents would have just kind of dropped me and left. So I never had that kind of external pressure, which probably helped. But on the other hand, it led to me just choosing a social life instead of tennis.
Right.
When I was about age, maybe 13, 14, I didn't want to be playing all these tournaments every weekend. I just wanted to be out having fun.
So after, did you go to uni after school?
I did, yeah. I was, again, very fortunate in that I was about 12 years old when I knew I wanted to become a physiotherapist.
How? What did you see?
I had a shoulder injury from playing tennis.
Oh, okay.
So I went to see a physio. And he, I still remember his name was Dave, and it was in a shed in his garden, and he just got back from the Olympics. And I was like, I want that job. I want to go to the Olympics as a physio. So I was very young. I knew instantly. So then I started getting loads of work experience. You know, age 13, 14, 15, I'd go down to local hospital and just spend time with the physios, spend time at the local private clinic. And I really did know I wanted to do physio. So when it came down to GCSE choices, A-levels, it was really easy for me. And then I went to study physiotherapy in Birmingham University, which was great fun.
That's amazing. I haven't met many people that know exactly what they want to do at an early age. Mm. Must have had a big impact on you for fixing your shoulder.
It must have, yeah. Like when you look back, because I was so sure. So I remember before that point, I wanted to be a brain surgeon.
Okay.
And then I had the physio. I was like, no, I don't want to be a brain surgeon anymore. I want to be a physio. And then there was a point when I was about 16 where I was weighing up between physio and radio presenter, which is quite interesting. Now I've gone down the podcast route as well.
Yeah.
So somewhere back then, there was a little bit of a desire to broadcast, but I put that in a hole for a long time.
Interesting, isn't it, how these thoughts pop up? So obviously you graduated with flying colours.
Yeah.
Where did you go to work after?
So I graduated in 2006 when it was very hard to get a job as a physiotherapist. So what the NHS,
why was it hard then?
Well, what happened is the NHS was funding people to do the course, which was great because it was all funded, but they were taking too many people on to train them. So we were all graduating and there wasn't enough jobs for us. And it was a very difficult period actually for quite a lot of people in the physiotherapy trade because we didn't really have anywhere else to go. It's a very vocational course.
Yeah.
I do know people that left the profession at that point, but again, I was very determined that I was going to stay as a physiotherapist. So I just kept, you know, application, eventually got a job, which was not the job I wanted at all. It was like in some community hospital. I didn't really enjoy it very much, but I knew it was a step in. And then I did that for a year. And then I did what's called my junior rotations in the NHS. Again, I always knew I wanted to be a sports physio, but this for me was just like stepping stones.
Yeah.
And I actually always speak to young physios now and I say, do it, do the NHS stuff first, because it was a means to an end for me. And I learned so many skills that you don't, I think, learn in private practice or sport. So I learned all my skills. I was in the NHS for 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah, just working my way up. Didn't love it. Like they used to make us do these on-calls, these respiratory on-calls, where you're on-call throughout the night and you get called in if someone can't breathe, like if they have breathing problems, like it's respiratory issues. And I used to turn up and I didn't have a clue what I was doing, honestly, because I was a musculoskeletal physio. I wanted to really be in sport.
Yeah.
So I'd go onto these on-calls at like 3 a.m. and I'd say to the nurse, hey, can I have some help, please?
Wow.
It was all a bit of, it was a bit of a joke that, but you had to do it, you know? So I'd do it, didn't enjoy that. But again, it was all a stepping stone. I was gradually getting experience on a football pitch. I was working for some low level league club for £5, you know, for a whole morning, driving all over like Hertfordshire, I think, getting a fiver, but just getting the experience of working in football. And then gradually building up that little experience here and there, meeting people until eventually I could apply for my first sport job, which I did after working as a physio for, I think it was about, it must have been like 10 years.
So then where did you work?
So then I worked for the British canoeing team. That was my first job for like British, like for Team GB kind of work. And that was with the canoe slalom team. That was great. A sport I had probably never heard of. But actually we have great success as Team GB. We've won Olympic medals in canoe slalom. It's really exciting. It's a really fun sport.
So what's your job as a physio? Do you prep them prior, inclusive in their training? Or is it when there's an injury, or what do you actually do?
Yeah,
for
we do a bit of everything. So our biggest thing really is to keep them fit and healthy so that they don't lose days to training. So if someone gets injured, then they can't train. And if they can't train, then they can't get prepared for the next competition. So our job really is to keep them fit, keep them healthy, and prevent injuries. So we do a lot before they get injured.
You set up your own practice.
Yeah, that was 2019, October.
Right. That's a time when none of us knew what was going to happen.
It was okay in October 2019. So I'd always wanted to have my own private practice. That had been like the ambition alongside going to the Olympics. So I set up my private practice. And it was going really well, to be honest. I was in a gym. It was going really well. I was working pretty hard. I was doing it alongside the sports stuff still. So it wasn't full-time private practice. It was just a few days a week, I think.
Were the clients from the gym or from?
A bit of both. Oh. I was going out marketing, but also some from the gym. And then March 2020 hit, didn't it? And that was our first lockdown.
Mm.
So that wasn't a great time to have a private practice.
No.
So we went online. So I kept seeing some people online. But for me, physio online is just... It's not optimal.
It's just such a weird thing. Obviously, physio says it in the title, doesn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, that's all people had back. Like, looking back, I'm like, that's all they had. So actually, it was probably more helpful than nothing.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was super frustrating. You know, you couldn't really help someone. You could try, give them advice, give them exercises, but I couldn't do really what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then May 2020 happened, and that's when... I was thrown an even bigger curveball when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. So that was when the private practice took a bit of a pause.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. I did actually continue to work for a little bit. Because it was online, again, I could do some virtual sessions without people really knowing that I didn't maybe look quite myself or wasn't quite myself.
Yeah.
So I did a bit of that.
How did you find out? Was there anything before...
Yeah, I mean, I actually quite like telling people how I find out because it's important for like awareness purposes.
Yeah.
Because most people think breast cancer, lumps. But mine was not. I had no lumps in my breasts. And I say exercise saved my life because I was out for a run, lockdown. I mean, that's all we could do really, wasn't it, lockdown? I would go out running as much as possible, exactly, and leave the kids at home. But when I got back from a run, I noticed on my sports bra, there was a tiny speck of like fluid, but tiny, like a pin drop of fluid. Yeah. And I'd probably only noticed it because I'd breastfed my kids. I knew what it looked like. Like, you know, when you breastfeed and you have, what's it called? Nipple leakage or whatever.
Yeah.
So I noticed this weird fluid and I was like, that is weird. Maybe that's because I haven't, I'd only stopped breastfeeding like a year, maybe 9 months before. Because I had an 18-month-old. I thought, that is really weird. So I ignored it. And then next day, went out for a run. Same thing, only ever in my sports bra. So it's basically a bit of nipple discharge.
Yeah.
And I actually, my first cousin had had breast cancer under the age of 40 a couple of years previously. So my mum had actually taken me to the breast clinic in 2019 for a check. So I had the card of the clinical nurse specialist. So I phoned her up.
Wow.
Yeah. And I said, this is a bit weird. Like, should I be worried? And she said, probably not, but come on in. So I went in for an appointment. I had an ultrasound and a mammogram and it was all normal. And they said, the doctor said, listen, come back in 6 weeks if it's still there. So 6 weeks later, we are now like proper midst of COVID. So, you know, I said to my husband, I don't want to go back to hospital. And luckily I listened to him because I don't normally listen to him. But he said, go. And I was like, oh, I don't want to. He said, no, go. So I went back in. And at that point, they did an MRI and they found the cancer. But it's very interesting because I'd had the normal ultrasound. I'd had the normal mammogram.
Yeah.
I didn't have any lumps, you know, and I could have easily just left it because it was COVID. But because I'd gone back, they were like, oh, let's look into this a bit further.
Why didn't that pick it up then at that time?
It was very deep, I think.
Right. And did they tell you there and then there was an issue?
It's all such a blur. You know, you kind of wipe those memories, don't you?
Yeah.
I remember they let me bring my husband to the appointment, which again, COVID, you weren't allowed anyone.
That's right.
So that was a bit of a red herring. But again, I don't remember worrying about that. And so I think when we went back to the appointment, that was when they told us the news you don't really ever want to hear, when they said I had breast cancer.
Yeah.
But, you know, luckily I remember the consultant saying this is fully treatable and fully curable. And I was very positive from the offset. I don't remember being scared, particularly that I was going to die. I remember thinking, it's fine, we got this.
How's your husband? I would have been in bits if he was me.
So I tell the story that I basically thought he was going to faint. He was awful. I remember he like lost his colour.
Yeah.
He wasn't great. But again, now it is also 4 years ago, and I don't try and think about those moments.
It's funny how the body reacts. It's for me anyway, from my experience, it's protected me where I've just gone, right, okay, let's do this. And then, you know.
It's like battle mode.
Yeah, it's like a shield of strength that there's nothing else we can do apart from let's just do this.
Yeah, just crack on.
Yeah.
So I was quite good. I was pretty good like that. And I tell the story that I exercised a lot during my cancer treatment. Well, when I say a lot. So I had chemo.
But you had a lot of, you had three different types of treatment, right?
I had chemotherapy first for 12 weeks. Then I had double mastectomy with reconstruction, and then I had radiotherapy. After radiotherapy, I then had a year of, what they call it, antibody therapy.
Yeah.
So that's every 3 weeks. And then I'm still on hormone therapy. So it's quite a big deal. But you do get stronger from some of these traumatic things we go through. And it has made me reflect on loads of things I never would have reflected on if that hadn't happened. Yeah. So positives have 100% come out of it.
Some things give you a wake-up call in life, which adds more colour to it, in my experience. What's the positives that have come out?
So my podcast.
Which is very good, by the way.
Yeah, When Life Gives You Lemons.
Yeah.
That came about because when I was going through treatment and COVID, I was walking all the time. Also, when I went through chemo, I was sat there by myself every week so you weren't allowed guests, you weren't allowed visitors in chemo. So I would put in my earphones basically. And that is when I discovered podcasts. I honestly don't think I'd ever listened to a podcast before. So I was a bit late to the game maybe, but I became obsessed with podcasts in that period. And I remember thinking, this could be fun. But it was just a little seed in my head. Yeah. And then I was walking a lot with friends. And there was one particular friend that I kind of said, you know what, I've got an idea of this podcast. And she kind of encouraged me through it. Whether I would have done that without her encouragement, I'm not sure. So starting my podcast definitely came out of that trauma. And through my podcast, I have now spoken to nearly 100 of the most interesting people, and they've been through incredible hardships, incredible trauma, and I've learned from them what they've learned. Yeah. So when I talk now, it's not based solely on what I've learned through my trauma, but it's what my guests have learned and discovered about themselves as well.
It's an incredible education, right?
I mean, it's just amazing.
Where did you get the title from? I know, obviously, the lemons thing, but when did that come to you?
So I'm not a very creative person, right? I'm the kind of person like at school, you come up with titles and I'd always have a really rubbish one. But for some reason, When Life Gives You Lemons just came to me, and everyone was like, that's really good. And I was like, is it? Oh, cool. It just came to me. So for once, I actually think I did get it right, because I actually think that now I love the title. Because, lemons do get thrown at us, and it's what we do with those lemons. How do we use them to come out better and stronger? And that is my favorite bit of what I like talking about now. And like you're saying, the positives are the podcast, what I've learned about myself. So incredible amounts of self-reflection.
What on reflection for you has been the positives in that way?
There's quite a lot of things. The main things I would say is I used to be very goal-driven. So, I said how I wanted to be a physio from age 12.
Yeah.
That's a good example. I always had a goal. I wanted to be a physio. I wanted to go to the Olympics. And I was always so intent on the next goal that I don't think I was enjoying the now enough.
Yeah.
Because I always wanted to get to the next point. And then I'd achieve that. And then I was like, right, what next? Whereas I've had so much reflection now to be like, well, actually, what's the point in always aiming for that next goal? Let's really try and enjoy the process. I've learned that from working with athletes as well. 100%. Right. You know, they're so kind of goal driven to win that Olympic medal. But actually, if they then don't win that medal, well,
that'd be devastating.
Yeah, what then? They've got another 4 years and they haven't even enjoyed the process.
In your understanding, can you have both? Because goals are important. Mm. But have you found a balance where you have a goal, but you can enjoy the process as you go to that goal?
So that's what I'm trying to work on. Right. And I'm also working on kind of shorter term goals. So you've got your long-term goals, because if you're that kind of person like me, I still have those long-term goals of things I would like to achieve, but I'm trying to set shorter goals as well. So every day, for instance, I'll wake up and it's like, what do I want to achieve by the end of today? And one of those short-term goals is kind of be grateful for what you got. So there is a bit of gratitude in there.
Yeah.
So it's enjoying the small things. It's not just kind of waiting for those big moments, but actually, I was really grateful. I had a lovely coffee on the way in this morning, you know. So being grateful and positive about what we've got every day, I think has really helped. So that is important.
Was there a first moment you were like, actually, I have gratitude for small things?
Yeah, I think it was when I was recovering and I remember being out on Hampstead Heath and just being so grateful for like the outdoors.
Yeah.
And I never used to be that into nature, by the way. but it was just kind of looking around me and being like, how beautiful is this? You know, like the greens and the colours of the trees and the birds.
Yeah.
So that's quite new for me. Did you have a first moment?
Yeah, I did. Mine was by a tree. I was in a treatment centre in London and I just was, I don't even remember how long I was, probably 4 weeks. And I was emotionally battered, like completely emotionally battered and spiritually battered, which I didn't know what that was at the time. And I just said to one of the therapists, I just need to walk. Can I walk? Because you weren't allowed to do any sports in there or anything. You weren't allowed to do press-ups or anything in case you got addicted to that. And they let me walk out the grounds. And I just sat by this tree and I had this moment where I was just like, God, what is this all about? I've exceeded my expectations, what I wanted to do in so many things, but I'd had a lot of hardships as well. And I just sat and I thought, what am I doing? Where am I going? Who are my friends? I just had this moment. I sat by this tree and all of a sudden I started to smell this cut grass. And then the noise of a bee come in and I saw the bee. And then I was looking at the leaves and I'm thinking, well, actually really pretty. And I just looked up at this tree and there was a plaque on the tree that the tree was planted. I think it was 200 years old. And it's irrelevant for everyone else. But for me, I sat there and I thought, oh my God, this tree, everything's so important. It's all about me. But this tree's been here for 200 years. I don't even know my relatives 200 years ago. I felt small. I felt really small and all my problems felt insignificant at that moment. And you can call it a spiritual awakening or a moment of just seeing what's around. I don't know. And I just sat there and I just touched the grass and smelled and I thought, oh my God, this is really beautiful. I didn't even know I'd been in the building for 4 weeks. I had no idea this was here, even though I'd seen it. This helped me physically to slow down and mentally to slow down.
Yeah.
So I used that to use my senses and that really derived from sitting by that tree.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. I've never really thought about that moment, but yeah, now you asked me about it, I do remember it quite clearly, quite similar. I wonder if most people have that moment associated with the outdoors as well.
It's definitely an expansion because I think a lot of us as humans, especially in the Western world, we're so focused on what we have to do, paying the bills, meeting people, how we're going to present ourselves, how we're going to pitch for a job or how we're going to succeed, how we keep the client, that it's all here. You're just thinking. And I think those moments come when there's a massive adversity happening. Or a big moment of clarity for whatever reason, you know. And I think the fortunate ones take that and use that moment of there's more to life than what I'm doing.
Yeah. And it is a work in process, a work in progress.
However you want to say it.
It is a work in progress.
Yeah.
I am 100% still working on it. You know, I have 3 young kids and that is hard sometimes to then just, you know, go back to yourself and just, like you said, slow down and not just be kind of thinking, oh, what have I got to do for that one and this one and this one? But we actually just need to kind of take a step back sometimes and slow down. And I am working on it.
When I slow down, I kind of know more, kind of understand a little bit more. And we practice it. It's hard with kids. We've got two young kids as well. And then I catch myself like, right, breakfast, I'm doing this. And we do, and I'll stop. And I'll be like, right, everyone stop. And we'll put on Classic FM. We'll all do a little breathing thing and we just slow down and do it. It's not a torture program. It's just we practice it. And now my oldest at seven, she's like, can we put on Classic FM, Daddy? Can we have a quiet breakfast this morning? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it.
Nice.
And it's something that we're practicing as a family as well, because it's really difficult.
Mm.
So after all the treatments, which you said, you know, was quite a lot, sounds like a serious thing. You made the decision that you wanted to do a triathlon, right?
Yeah.
Which is pretty epic.
Yeah.
Was it your last treatment, in your last year of treatment?
So I did that. It was sat in the chemo chair. I decided I was going to do the London Triathlon because I'd actually been signed up to do the London Triathlon the August of COVID, of 2020. Yeah. So, but because of COVID, it had been cancelled.
Right.
I actually was going through cancer treatment at that point anyway. So I remember sitting there having chemo in August and saying, right, this time next year, I'm going to do the London Triathlon. And then I did. So a year later, I basically did it. It was only 3 weeks after finishing all active cancer treatment.
Wow.
So it was pretty epic.
Yeah.
But I used the guidance of a physiologist to help me with my training program. And so he was a specialist that worked with like oncology patients. So he was guiding me through how much and how hard I could work, because obviously I was on drugs that I couldn't fully push myself.
Yeah.
So I did quite a lot, but that kept me sane. You know, I said at the beginning, exercise saved my life. This was another way that exercise just saved me. It was throughout cancer treatment, it was the only thing that I could control.
How was that when you crossed the line?
Yeah, that was pretty emotional. It was amazing. It was a really emotional, incredible day.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did it.
That's like a massive win-win on all sorts of levels.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
And after that, was you like, I'm just going to go back to work, I'm just going to work with clients again? How was the process after?
Yeah, so there was a bit of a switch there as well. In that I'd been working so hard in that private practice, but you know, like we're talking about, I'd reflected so much on myself and my values, and I decided that actually I didn't know if I wanted that anymore. I was working so hard, such kind of crazy hours, but not really getting much enjoyment from it. And I was like, why am I doing this? What for? And it was really because I had always said I wanted a private practice. That was why I was doing it.
Amazing.
I kind of had this goal, this ambition that I'd set when I was 12 years old, and that's why I was doing it. So when I reflected on it, I was like, I don't want to be doing this at the moment. So I haven't gone back to the private practice yet. I'm not saying it won't become something I would like to do at some point, but that was not where my passion was lying in 2021 when I went back to work.
Where did that move to? Because that's actually a very poignant thing to say, because a lot of people, including myself, have set a goal and I have to do it either to make sure I've done what I've done or because I told other people I've done it.
Yeah.
So it's actually quite a big moment.
It was a big moment.
Yeah.
But I remember I said I had the sports physio thing at the same time. So I'd always had these two goals. One goal was to go to the Olympics. One goal was to have the private physio. So I still had that goal of going to the Olympics.
Mm.
So instead of the private practice world, I just threw myself into the Olympics world. And then last summer I went to Paris. I went to Paris Olympic Games 2024, which was like incredible. You know, that was a real like moment of when you have set a long-term goal and you've achieved it. And it was an amazing life experience being there.
Yeah.
So no regrets at all about throwing myself into that side of things. And I also, you know, I want life to be interesting. I had a podcast guest say that actually, Luke Tarrant.
Yeah.
He said he'd always just, like he does things because he wanted his life to be interesting. And it really resonated with me. I was like, yeah, I really want life to be interesting. And I just didn't find the private practice world was kind of giving me that interestingness at that time.
Yeah. I was going to ask you that question actually about you've had many, many brilliant guests on there, and what's the things that have stood out that have helped you?
Oh, there are so many. So I recently did a talk because I've started to go into a bit of motivational speaking as well. And I did some slides of what I've learned from my guests, and just narrowing it down was honestly impossible. There's so many just quotes that I've learned, you know, simple things like not thinking, not why me, but what now?
Yeah.
You know,
powerful switch.
It's just that is a massive, powerful mindset switch for me.
Yeah, it is. When you started the podcast, was it, you know, because you had that thought way on earlier about being on the radio, maybe as a presenter and stuff. How was that process?
There was massive imposter syndrome there, because I was like, I'm a physio. I shouldn't be sat in front of a microphone with cameras. So I did have a big, oh, this is uncomfortable. Why do I think I can do this? But I think I had quite a lot of support from the people around me to be like, no, yeah, just give it a go. Try it out. You know, why not? What have I got to lose? I'm also fairly confident in myself, which helps. So I was able to kind of give myself a little pat on the back and say, like, whatever, just go for it. Just give it a go.
Yeah.
What have you got to lose? What is the worst thing that can happen?
Great,
people won't like it. And I'm still kind of, every so often I'll have the same thing. You know what it's like now having a podcast. It is a congested market.
It's a lot of work as well.
It's a lot of work that we don't get paid for. Well, I don't get paid for it. It's like the most expensive hobby
don't
I have.
Neither do I.
You know, I describe it as the most expensive hobby I have, really, at the moment. I'd love to be able to monetize it to a significant level one day. But the amount of work you have to put into that is fairly crazy, but I love it. I do really enjoy it. I think some of my interview skills have come from my physio as well. So when someone comes to see me as a physio, my job is to work out what is going on.
Yeah.
And I think...
So you're asking questions naturally, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're investigating.
I'm an investigator, really. That's how I really nail down, you know, if you've hurt your ankle, there's so many structures that it could be, but my job is to nail down what structure you've actually damaged.
Yeah.
And a lot of that comes out of our questioning. So I do think I had some interview skills within me from the last 20 years. So that maybe gave me a bit more confidence when I did feel a bit shaky. But yeah, I still feel shaky every now and then.
How's your mindset now? Because you still work with people as a physio and super athletes. How has all the podcasts and your own experience benefited you when you're working with other people? Because you have to have conversations while you're working, I assume.
Yeah. I think the podcast conversations have helped me understand people. So helped me understand like the athletes I work with as a physiotherapist, as well as the people I'm interviewing. So I just understand, like, you know, the concept of mindset a bit more and the concept of goals, which actually in physio world, we talk a lot about goal setting. So that's changed how I might approach a physio problem.
In what sense?
So again, it's the kind of long-term goals versus short-term goals.
Yeah.
So it's not just about in 3 months' time, you're going to be walking. It's, well, tomorrow you're going to be able to move your ankle up and down. As an example.
Yeah.
So I've just kind of breaking it down a lot more.
Because you have little dopamine levels, little knowledge is okay, I've made it forward, I made it forward.
Yeah.
That's really important.
It's also, I think, about finding meaning, you know? So it's the importance of finding meaning in these little tasks.
Yeah.
So not just getting someone to kind of move their ankle up and down, but, you know, what is the importance of that? Or how can they do that in a fun way that's going to be meaningful for them?
So working with these athletes, how does the body work with mindset? Because I know when I'm injured, which I am at the moment, I can't run and it affects me deeply.
Yeah, tell me about it. I'm currently injured, as you know, with a broken toe and I can't run and it affects me massively. You know, I like to say there's no mind without body and no body without mind. So they are so related.
Yeah.
And if I'm treating someone's body, I'm 100% aware of what is going on in their mind as well. Running for me is like my therapy.
Yeah.
It really is. It's really important for my mind. So when you don't have that, it's like, well, what can I do instead?
Yeah.
It's really hard. But also being injured helps me understand how my athletes feel. You know, if I'm telling them not to run,
yeah,
I understand some of their frustrations.
If one of our guests is going through something that's big to them in their world, what advice would you give?
Trying not to be a victim, you know, not that thing of don't say why me, but what now? How can I use that experience to help others around me?
That's really powerful because it's true. Mm. I know now if I fall into, oh, why me? It feels like I have this heavy syrup almost pulling me down in my body. And I don't use that sentence, but I snap out and I literally like, okay.
Yeah.
What can I learn? What can I do? How can I help someone?
Yeah.
Really well done. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk today.
Thank you. This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.